about were two rather different experiences, I mean different from one another. One of them was after we had relieved all the Antarctic bases and we were travelling north in open water. Well, only a marine navigator can convey to you the exhilarating sense of freedom that comes to you when you break free of the ice pack and you're once again in open water. And we were heading north towards the Falklands after a particularly arduous tour of duty. And I went into the chart room to look at the Falkland Island charts to assess all the factors concerning the landfall. You know, when you were likely to reach soundings, as it's called. And I was studying the chart when suddenly it was quite an amazing experience. It was as though something had got me by the shoulders and propelled me out of the chart room onto the wing of the bridge. And when I got there, I didn't know whether I was looking at a reflection of the chart projected in front of you, which you get if you come from studying a white chart out into the night, or whether it was an iceberg. But I acted automatically and gave the order hard to starboard and pulled the telegraph to full astern, because on a right-handed screw, if you put the wheel hard over and go full astern, the ship turns very violently but very quickly, heels right over. And it was a mercy that I did, because there was an isolated berg and the lookout had nodded off to sleep. He hadn't seen it. And with us going full speed, if I hadn't been there and done that, we would undoubtedly have hit it and become an unknown marine casualty. And I can't explain it. I only know that I experienced it. And the particular circumstances of it, to me, cannot be explained by saying that it was a hallucination of any kind. The other experience I want to tell you about is far more material in content, but quite funny, really. We were travelling in open water, I believe, between Coronation Island and Cygne. And my watch, of course, was the 12 to 4. And the depth recorder was working. Now, the instruction book said it was one of these, it was an American machine, and it had a circular dial with a red blip on it. And according to the instruction manual, this device, by the way, measured up to 200 fathoms, and it could not over-record, meaning that if it went round to 200 fathoms, it would then cut out that if it showed 5 fathoms, that was 5 fathoms, not 205. Mm. Well, we were supposedly in deep water, and I switched on this machine. I expect it must have been somewhere around about 2 o'clock in the morning, about the middle of the watch. I'm not too sure about that, but it doesn't really matter that. And to my astonishment, I got a reading of 5 fathoms. So I immediately slowed down, because if we were running into shoal water, you know, full speed was not the way to proceed. So we got down to slow ahead, and this stayed at 5 fathoms, and then it went to 3 fathoms. So I stopped. There was the telegraph at stop. I thought, well, it was fortunately very calm weather. And I thought, what do we do now? Because the ship was coasting along, and then it stopped, and the reading was somewhere round about between 2 and 3 fathoms. And I thought, well, we can't be really on a shoal. But the responsibility was mine, and so I had the watch use a sounding lead, and they couldn't find bottom. And so I thought, well, this is ridiculous. We perched on a pinnacle of rock. So I wondered what to do. And of course, the men were highly amused about this, particularly the bosun, who obviously knew more than the others what was going on. And so very gently I eased the telegraph to slow ahead, hoping that there was going to be no rending of timbers. Nothing happened. Shortly afterwards, the reading was 180 fathoms. You know, it just went back. And I had an immense sigh of relief, because I realised that the thing had over-recorded. But to a navigating officer, it wasn't a very comfortable experience. And although you pass on the information that this thing can over-record, you don't put things like that down in the logbook, because it would make you look too silly.
Is that true?
Pardon?
It's a recording device. It's...
Yes, an echo sounder.
Yeah, it's
an echo sounder, yes. And it had a circular dial, and the manual said that it couldn't over-record, meaning that, as I say, that if it was 5 fathoms, that meant that it was 5 fathoms and not 205. But on this, for whatever reason, it must have been recording round, mm-hmm. And because there's no other explanation. But I found it a very uncomfortable experience.
much like one.
Much easier to talk about afterwards than experience at the time.
You just said that the man who you brought to the Antarctic on your boat had also been at the same frontier that Shackleton had been.
Yes, but not to anything like, what shall I say, we didn't suffer anything like the privations that he did. I suppose this experience that I just told you about me being propelled out onto the wing of the bridge, it doesn't really compare with Shackleton's experiences. But to me, it is an example of an interaction of two planes of activity, the human and something more. This side of the horizon that we call death. I don't think we shall know or understand any more about it. But to me, the experience was real. And just as the experience of Shackleton and his party, when they had the impression that there was a fourth member there, when they knew there were only three of them, that experience was real to them. Do you get my meaning? I wouldn't like to in any way to suggest that the privations we suffered were anything like those that Shackleton and his men experienced.
So something changed during this 10 years.
How do you mean?
Something must have changed because you both went to the same circumstances, the same geographical circumstances as Shackleton went.
Yes. But their hardships were infinitely more arduous than ours. Just the same as our experiences were, in some ways, harder than those than what people would experience today.
How would you describe Shackleton?
As a great leader of men. A very competent seaman, and a man with a well-founded belief in providence or the love of God, whichever way you like to put it, and a man of great vision and determination. This to me is proved by his amazing ability to bring what you might call a victory out of disaster. And his capacity to do that was really quite amazing. And I mean, I've only got the records to go on, but having seen those areas and experienced the type of seas that he sailed that open boat through 800 miles of, I find it quite amazing that he achieved what he did. Quite incredible. Where he says, the rope could not be recovered. We had flung down the adze from the top of the fall and also the logbook wrapped in one of our blouses. That was all we brought except our wet clothes from the Antarctic, which a year and a half before we had entered with a well-found ship, full equipment and high hopes. That was all of tangible things, but in memories we were rich. We had pierced the veneer of outside things. We had seen God in his splendours. We had heard the text that nature renders. We had reached the naked soul of man. Mind you, Shackleton could write good descriptive English. But I felt that his heart was in that.
Now, you said that this the frontier, of which you spoke earlier, was sometimes reached during the 40s and the time that you were there.
Yes, I did. I did say that. I'm wondering if really that was a true analogy, because there were times, particularly when we were going into, when I say the Argentine Islands, that is just the Argentine archipelago, the group of islands, and they were just a set of dots on the Antarctic chart, and they were not on the sketch maps that I had. And it was a very hazardous thing to take a ship in there. We had to ask the base to light a fire so that we could see the smoke coming up. And also when we went in there, we had to lower a boat, and with some men, and one of whom had a lead line, and we had to follow the boat in. Well, this was a similar procedure from what to what seamen had followed for many, many years, centuries in fact, when they were going into uncharted waters and making a landfall. This is how they entered harbours. They had to. There's no other way to do it because you don't know what's there. Well, the responsibility on you when you have to do this is rather great. And you really have to trust in your guardian angel, if you like, because you have to make decisions and you just hope that they are the right ones. In my case, they were. And to that extent, I reached my own frontier, because these frontiers are to some extent personal things. And you are tested to the limit of your own abilities and your own faith at that particular time. The fact that in a different age and at a different time, that frontier is a different place for a different man, is to a certain extent beside the point. You have to cope with it when it's in front of you. And you are conscious of the lives that are dependent upon you making the right decision. Yes, 1st of March, 2nd of March. That's 1948. So we would have been working through pack ice late in February and in early March. Which is late in the season.
So late.
Well, for one thing, we were late starting anyway, and another thing was the difficulties that we had while we were down there. You know, trying to push south in very difficult conditions, and it was only that we were able to follow that American icebreaker into Marguerite Bay that we were able to get near enough to Stonington Island at all. And the extra time that was spent and of course the ice conditions held us up, so that the sea was already beginning to freeze before we were clear of pack ice, which is a very hazardous position for a wooden ship. Fortunately, we made it.
For a steel ship?
Well, then it depends. It depends on the construction of the ship and as to whether it has reinforced bows that enable it to work through pack. I mean, an ordinary a steamship like the, I mean, at one time, because of the non-availability of other ships, I believe that the Falkland Island, one of the Falkland Island Company's steamers, you know, the mail steamer that goes between Stanley and Montevideo, I believe that went south to some of the more northern Antarctic bases. Well, a ship like that, although it was a steel ship, would have to be extremely careful about ice navigation, because the bows were not sufficiently strengthened to withstand the pressures that would be encountered. But I mean, the modern Antarctic research ships have specially reinforced bows, and their design is such that they are able to work through pack quite safely in normal conditions. But of course, apart from the very large icebreakers, no ship is able to withstand the worst pressures that an ice pack, the pack ice, can exert, particularly if it is caught near a lee shore, where the ice starts rafting. A ship can come under, any ship can come under intolerable pressures then. And of course that is a thing to avoid, but this is why a ship can only winter in the Antarctic in a very sheltered position. You know, you operate down there in the Antarctic summer, and you come away for that reason, because you can't operate there in the Antarctic winter. You know, there would be no research program possible. It just wouldn't be feasible to do it. There'd be no point in doing it.
But this time the human presence in Antarctica is purely scientific.
Yes. At the present time.
At the present time.
Yes.
But at this time after the war, it also seems quite scientific.
Oh yes, yes. I think the one of the driving influences was the interest of the Argentine in our Antarctic territories. I think this is what prompted this expedition. That's interesting because I didn't have colour film then.
Stormy night, the sky made horizon bright green, gradually merging into purple and to a jet black overhead.
We were swept out to sea with both anchors down that night. Yes. Of course, that's a hut that's been completely covered. But there was something here. Ah, yes. That was me. This is an example. See, a heavy load. You can see how that boat was loaded, because there's an oar going right across the heads of the men that are rowing. Just to give the idea of how much those boats were loaded. I mean, the freeboard sometimes was only about 3 inches. We ran very great risks. And of course, when you beached at the other end, it was not a jetty. And so the heavier the load, the lower the boat was in the water. And so the further out you had to jump in. And then all this stuff had to be manhandled up the beach. It was hard work. You see, that
responsibilities, it is a big part, plays a big role in also in your experience. When you call, say, like meeting the frontier, being at frontier and acting when you are there, and you tell me a story about the depth meter.
Yes, yes.
Reading, and you tell about Shackleton.
Yes.
It is actually seems to be about taking responsibility for
yes, it
yourself
does.
Or for others.
Yes, it does.
And not so much with providence.
Well, you see, unless you trusted in a providence, not that you were conscious of it, except in a fleeting sense sometimes. You know, I would sometimes think, oh God, I hope I'm doing the right thing. But then you've got to do it, because you can't say anything like that to people around you who are expecting you to give orders and to know what to do. And sometimes the only way that you can do it is admitted you have got to have some professional knowledge and experience. But to a certain extent, in my view, you trust in providence as well as your own ability. But there are plenty of people that would say that they trust in their own ability because they were quite oblivious of any providential assistance ever being there, and so they can't call on something that they don't believe is there. And that's a valid viewpoint. I mean, on those salvage tugs, I met men who would only use the name of Christ to swear by, and they would be regarded as very rough and uncouth sort of men. And they were, by certain standards. But I have also known them quite willingly put their life on a line in an attempt to save other people. And so that one can... Some people would argue, therefore, Providence has got nothing to do with it. But I would say Providence sometimes uses the most unlikely servants. It's just a way of looking at it. Do you get what I mean? You see, in all these things, it is to some extent the standpoint from which you view it. You can get quite different accounts of the same happening, but it's seen from different standpoints by different people. Mm-hmm. But this is always the case. From the standpoint from which they speak, each standpoint can be correct for the person that's making it. It's just the assessment and the interpretation is different.
How about people on the boat? We had Fuchs on the boat, Eddie Dalglish.
Yes, and various sorts of seamen. Well, of course, the scientific staff are they took part in shipboard life, but most of them were interested naturally, mainly, in their own particular discipline, like the glaciologist is interested in ice and glaciers and so on. And the geologist, he can't wait to get and look at the rocks. And the naturalist is very keen to observe seals, penguins and all sorts of other natural life. And this, to some extent, colours their attitude to the voyage and their attitude to the expedition as a whole. And the seamen have quite a different approach to it, and it's quite interesting to see how even amongst the seamen different personalities reacted differently to what happened. And to many of them, that it was just another sailoring job with a difference. Whereas the scientific staff saw and noticed all sorts of things that most of the sailors didn't notice at all. But I mean, this is bound to be. And of course, they react quite differently to stressful and difficult situations. In many ways, you could say that the what you meet in the Antarctic causes you to to search for and use your deepest resources. The situations that you meet call them forth. And it tends to tell you and others what you've got and what you haven't.
You've seen these men before they actually were there. You sort of brought them on the way there to Antarctica.
Yes, yes.
When you saw them back later, could you recognize that they had been there?
I would say definitely yes. Yes. It broadens your experience of life in all sorts of ways. And generally speaking, it shows. Yes. Mind you, I found the same thing at sea during the war. That I mean, I grew up at sea. When I say grew up, as I said earlier, the years between 18 and 21, or more so between 18 and 25, are very important developing years. And depending on what you experience and what you have to do and how you cope with it between those times, well, it has a lasting effect on you, I'm sure.
How old were these men?
Well, I suppose, because Fuchs was older, but most of them were ranging from very early 20s to early 30s, round about that time. And the chief officer of the ship, Lord Headley, I think he was in his middle 50s, but he was regarded as quite an old hand to be down there. But he was a very unorthodox character, but I was very glad he was there. I had a very good relationship with him and was greatly indebted to him, because he had a master mariner's certificate in steam and sail. Well, that is very unusual. Well, I say unusual. It wasn't unusual at the beginning of the century, but it was unusual in the 1940s to find somebody that was a sailing ship man, or had been. I mean, he'd run away to sea and served his time on Cape Horners, and he got his Master Mariner's certificate the year I was born. And I used to pull his leg and tell him he was my sea daddy, you see. And but he was a big help. And but certainly I would also say that once you have lived with 3 years on the deck of Dutch ocean going tugs, there is not much in the seafaring world that you shrink from. In other words, is what I'm really saying to you is that I served in a good training school, school of life. In a forecastle on Dutch tugs.
Can I have a look at the map?
Oh, yes.
But who also I have
immense respect for and great interest in his work was Nansen, the Norwegian. Yeah. He also was a very great man. Fascinating character, you know. But of course, he wasn't concerned with the Antarctic. He was concerned with the Arctic. But he did a tremendous amount of pioneering work. And of course, his humanitarian work after his Arctic work was finished was sufficient to earn him a place in history, anyway. But he was a fascinating character. But he was a man, you see, that I don't know that he would have described himself as an atheist, but he was certainly a free thinker. Mm-hmm. And he had he certainly had no professed religious faith. Well, I mean, I don't think Shackleton had, from the point of view of supporting any given denomination. But that he just had a what shall I say, a belief and a trust in the workings of Providence. But this was in part due to how he felt Providence had treated him. But I find all these things very interesting, in fact, fascinating.
Is it just as easy for you to get to know or to find what makes the people tick whom you brought to Antarctica?
Sorry, do I?
Is it just as easy for you to find out what made Shackleton tick as what made the people tick whom you brought to Antarctica?
No, I don't find it easy to find out what the people that I went to Antarctica with. But what made them tick. But there are various reasons for that. One of them is that I was so thundering busy that we couldn't talk about things like that. Mm-hmm. There, and so we never discussed it. The other thing is that I don't know, and this is not unusual, I don't know any of them well enough, because to come to an understanding of these things, you need to have a long and trustworthy relationship with them. Otherwise, these subjects don't arise.
You don't know Shackleton.
But you see, Shackleton is back in history, and there are various accounts of his life, and people have made a study of it, and you can see all sorts of things laid out, and you can consider them. Well, on that basis, you can let, because how many times do you feel that you, for example, that you read an obituary of somebody, you know, that's just died, and it's somebody that you thought you knew well, but you read things in his obituary and you think, my God, did he do that? Did he think that? I never knew anything about it. Well, it's the same with people that you go to the Antarctic with. I mean, they won't know much about me, and I shan't know much about them until, well, partly they might read it from obituary notices, and partly if somebody thinks it's important enough to analyse me and put it on paper, well, then they'll understand something about me. And it's the same for the people that we took. I don't think you ever do know them well enough to be able to say, unless you have years of association with them. And you know, you're too close to the situation to see it in perspective. And as I repeat, at the time, you're that thundering busy with what you've got to do that you haven't got time to talk about things like this.